Good evening, everyone. Our procession is about to start. Before it does that, I'd like to ask you to turn off any mobile phones and paging devices. And I would also like to mention we're filming this proceedings, and if there is anyone who would prefer not to be filmed, those seats over at the other side, the camera won't go on that area. So if you'd like to avoid being filmed, please move. And if you'd like to stand up, I think the procession will be coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the University of Melbourne and to the first of our Indigenous orations in Parkville, the Ngurrum Oration. I would like to welcome particularly Professor David Pennington, the former Vice-Chancellor of our University, and to Senator Rachel Seward from the Australian Greens. We've called the oration Ngurrum Oration, Ngurrum being the Wiriwarring word for the area around Port Phillip Bay. And this is a companion oration to the Dungala Kayala Oration, which we hold each year in Shepparton. In a moment, Auntie Joy Wanton Murphy will conduct the Welcome to Country. But before I introduce her, may I tell you about our program for today and about our visitors from New Zealand. That will save you from hearing from me again and again before each speaker as they rise and speak. First, as the program, as I've said, there will be a welcome to country. Then we will hear the Maori karanga to Professor Jerry's oration. Following the oration, Professor Susan Elliott will respond to it on behalf of the university. And then our Vice-Chancellor, Professor Glenn Davis, will launch the new Marib Barak Institute. And after the launch, Professor Ian Anderson, Director of the Institute, will reflect on the meaning of the day to the university. May I now tell you something about our distinguished guests from New Zealand. Our orator today, as you've heard, is Professor Mason Dury. Mason is a member of the Rangitani Ngati Kufata and the Ngangi Rukawa tribes. He graduated in medicine in 1963, completed a specialist training in psychiatry at McGill University, Montreal in 1970, and was subsequently appointed Director of Psychiatry at the Palmerston North Hospital in New Zealand. From 1986 to 1988, he was commissioner on the Royal Commission on Social Policy and was appointed chair in Maori Studies at the Massey University in 1988. He's currently Professor of Maori Research and Development and was very recently appointed to the role of Deputy Chancellor at Massey University. He's on the governing body of the Tuwanga Arokawa, a tribal tertiary educational institution. He chairs the New Zealand Vice Chancellor's Maori Advisory Standing Committee and is also chair of the Massey University Academy for Maori Research and Scholarship. His research interests include Maori health, with special focus on mental health, Maori development, and Maori futures planning. He has written extensively on Maori and Indigenous development, and in 2009 developed the Parangi Lectures on the Maori in 2030. He's currently chairing the Ministerial Task Force on the Service Delivery of Maori Families and is a member of the Health Research Council Long Range Strategic Advice Committee. As I mentioned, Mesa will come to the rostrum to give his oration in response to a special Maori call known as Karanga. The Karanga will be given by Professor Arroyo Jiri. Arroyo Jiri is a member of the Ngāti Puru, the Rongo Afakata and Ngāi Tahu tribes. She has degrees in sociology and education from Massey University. Her doctoral thesis analysed public policy for Maori education and implications for successive generations of Maori children. After teaching at primary and secondary schools, she joined the academic staff of the Massey University and as Professor of Maori Education established the School of Maori and Multicultural Education. She has served on several national education committees and has been a long-standing member of the Massey University Human Ethics Committee and the University Research Committee. Her own research interests include Maori education policy, the constitutional position of Indigenous Pacific peoples, and the transmission of Maori language and culture within families. As I've mentioned, Aroa's Karanga will follow the welcome to country, which will be given by Auntie Joy. For many of us, she needs no introduction. She's a valued patron of the university's Indigenous programs and a regular visitor to our campus. Auntie Joy is an Aboriginal elder of the Wurundjeri people, and she's been involved with Aboriginal issues for 30 years or more. She's chairperson of the Australian Indigenous Consultative Assembly and has held executive positions across many sectors of government. Auntie Joy holds, amongst other positions, that of honorary professor at Swinburne University. She's a trustee of the National Gallery of Victoria, a member of the Victoria Police Ethical Standards Consultative Committee and the Equal Opportunity Commission. She's also an Australian Day Ambassador and operates amongst her other activities, her own business. So far as a first step in the program, it gives me great pleasure to invite Auntie Joy to the lectern now to give welcome to country.
Quite emotional tonight looking at my great-great-uncle's artwork, but nevertheless, I'd like to begin by paying my respects to my father and to my ancestors, and of course to my great-great-uncle, William Barak, or his traditional name, Barak. Could I also acknowledge our elders and ancestors of this great country of ours and pay my respects to them and thank them for giving us the diligence, the strength and the courage to continue on, not only with our lives, but with our culture. And I'd also like to pay my respects to all of our elders that indeed have passed on, including my eldest two brothers that have gone to the dream time just in the last couple of years, especially my eldest brother who was the Ngarangita, or the head man of the Wurundjeri people, which leaves me in the position of being the senior elder of the Wurundjeri people. It is a great honour and a privilege, but also one can expect to stand up to what is put in front of oneself and also to accept those challenges as the Ngarangita himself would have done. I'd also like to acknowledge the presence of brothers and sisters that are with us tonight and just say to you how proud I am to see you all. And, you know, when we speak about our community, it's with, especially from the elders of the community, it's an honour to be able to know where our community has come from, know where you are now, and certainly know the direction that you are giving our community to continue. And in the group of our colleagues, could I also acknowledge Paul Briggs that's with us this evening and was mentioned by the Chancellor to say that, Paul, it's a special honour to have you with us tonight on this on the NAM oration. I'd also like to acknowledge Chancellor Alex Chernov and say it's a great pleasure to meet you at long last, and our associations are somewhat through my late husband. So it's quite an occasion for me this evening. Could I also acknowledge Vice Chancellor and all of our the chancellors that are with us this evening, and of course that includes Dr. Ian Anderson, who is one of our foremost leaders at such a time when it's so necessary, but firmly still has his feet on the ground. Could I also acknowledge our very special guests who have also been mentioned, and but also to say that kia ora to Aurora, and to Mason, it is an honour to have you on Wurundjeri country, and I hope that your stay with us is as enjoyable as can be, but certainly the spirit of this country, I hope, will give you great comfort and keep you safe. The NAM oration, as you've already heard, NAM actually is the Woi Wurrung word for Melbourne, and the adjoining areas. And for me, it's such a privilege to have language, the Woi Wurrung language, especially included in the oration tonight. And again, I do want to thank Dr. Ian Anderson for his innovations and, of course, carrying those through. I guess when we talk about the oration and what it might mean to me specifically and to the Wurundjeri people, it is important to say to you that we are a community that's indeed very strong. We are a community that indeed is the minority. But of course, we know that with many of our colleagues in all our various areas of work that we are supported, and I'd like to thank you personally for coming along this evening. My great honour in my life has been, I guess there are quite a few moments when I'd like to reflect on, but I think the most important honour for me, as I said earlier, is to be the senior elder of the Wurundjeri people. Lonely and all as it might be, not having your family around you to support you, not being able to seek that advice from someone who's older than you or has indeed inherited such a position. But it is through the spirit of my eldest brother, the Narangita, that I would like to acknowledge that we are still and always will be on Wurundjeri country here in NAM. When I was born, I was the second eldest girl, and for me, it's again that honour and privilege that I have to be the eldest living girl of our family of 10. So together with my father's siblings, his parents, and my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, or great-grandchild, I extend a welcome to you on this very special occasion. These leaves, although looking a little bit weathered tonight, are from where I live still today, and where there is such great strength that comes from that area because of the ability to have been able to have been born on your birthplace and being able to remain there, and of course have many generations before you born there, lived there, and as I said, three generations beyond me. And of course Corran Dirk is within that land where I live, or I actually live on the land of Corran Dirk. So from my country to yours, I extend a welcome to country by offering you as the Yanibal to share from these branches of gum leaves, which is our belonging. Each Aboriginal community is known by its geographical area, or a bird, or the animal of that area. So these leaves are extended to you. The gift of this land is one of the most precious resources that we have, and we as the first people of this land acknowledge that great resource and that special gift. This leaf, should you accept it, means that you are welcome to everything, from the tops of the trees to the roots of the earth. And it also means, because we share from this gift of the earth, that we become linked symbolically. And I'd like to thank you, because it means that you also join with us to pay your respects and honour the spirits of our ancestors who have nurtured this very land here in Naam for many, many thousands of years. But with this goes a responsibility, the same responsibility that my ancestors before me, and indeed all ancestors of this great country of ours, is that what we've been given is special. But in order to maintain it and retain it, we need to care for what we've been given. We need to nurture not only the land, but we need to nurture each other and know that the spirit of country is always with you, so long as respect is given. It is a great privilege to be here tonight in my language, the Woi Wurrung, Wamindjikar, Wurundjeri Balak, Yemenkundi Bik, and you are most welcome to the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. Thank you.
Tu e te rangi e tu nei, tu e te papa e takoto kei wahora, tu e rātou ko wehi atu ki te pō uriuri, te pō tangotango, tu e te hongaora ki te hongaora, o tira tu e ngā tangata whenua o tēnei ao ki te papa whenua, tu e hoki ngā tangata whenua o te ao whānui tui. Chancellor, the verse I've just recited reminds us of the close and enduring bonds between people, the land, and the sky. It also remembers those whose journeys preceded our own and recognises the spirit of unity present among us here tonight. And it pays tribute to the traditional owners of this land and their long-standing attachment to the earth, while acknowledging the sense of connectedness between Indigenous peoples all over the world. Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed an honour to be asked to deliver the 2009 Ngarama Oration, especially as it coincides with the launch of Murup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. My wife and I, as well as the other Māori academics who are here tonight, are deeply appreciative of the welcome. Thank you, Auntie Joy. And we appreciate the chance to participate in this landmark ceremony, accompanied as it is by the prospect of strengthened partnerships in the years ahead. The Ngarama Oration presents an opportunity to consider the more recent journeys of Indigenous peoples and the mutual benefits that might arise from teaching and research within universities. Although much can be said about Indigenous development, the good news is that there's actually only one single conclusion underlying this oration. Simply, by bringing together two bodies of knowledge, there will be better prospects than either one could offer alone. The concurrence of the two, Indigenous knowledge on the one hand and the knowledge contained in the universal academic disciplines will afford greater opportunities for Indigenous peoples to participate in global economies while retaining those elements of custom and culture that will be important to future generations. In parallel, there will be greater incentives for the academy, the university, to create a type of scholarship that will be distinctive, grounded in the Australian landscape, germane to all learners, and relevant to national and global goals. In a world where technological innovation and scientific discovery are proceeding at unprecedented rates, the appreciation of different systems of knowledge will be increasingly important, so that approaches to human advancement might be both relevant and balanced. Bringing together different bodies of knowledge does not infer an amalgamation or a fusion of traditions, but it recognises that together, the elaboration of old knowledge and the creation of new knowledge have the potential to offer fresh insights. In that respect, the deliberate inclusion of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous knowledge in the academy will bring with it the chance of creating a model of engagement where the politics of difference can be transformed into the spirit of partnership, and the old and the new can be seen as allies rather than adversaries. It could be argued that in a new world, there is no place for old knowledge, or that because Indigenous knowledge often defies scientific measurement, it amounts to little. But the perception of Indigenous knowledge and culture as applicable only to distant times ignores the thrust for development that is actually part of the Indigenous journey, and it fails to capture Indigenous vitality and the meaning of resilience. At the same time, the suggestion that universities, academic institutions, the suggestion that they have a perfect model for future development falls well short of the ideal. Too often, for example, economic growth and environmental sustainability have travelled in opposite directions. Social equity and individual freedoms have not always reached the same endpoint. Enhanced educational achievement has often been the preserve of the few, and the humanities have been studied as if they bore no relationship to the sciences or to technological innovation. As institutions that shape attitudes and mould societies, universities are well placed to lead an integrated approach to development and the promotion of social cohesion. The inclusion of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous knowledge within a university framework of connected development will represent a major step towards achieving those goals of social cohesion. For some Indigenous communities, I expect there will be a degree of scepticism about the capacity of a university to contribute to Indigenous development. But it is well to remember that the resilience of Indigenous populations owes much to an ability to adjust to changing circumstances and to engage with new institutions and new opportunities. The possibility of extinction of a whole population, which was widely predicted for Māori in New Zealand towards the close of the 19th century, for example, was met by a major rejuvenation of tribal initiative, better access to education, and Māori leadership in national politics and in public health. Similar demographic trends have also been seen in Australia. A rapid decline of pre-contact population, which was thought to be more than a million, followed by a dramatic increase during the 20th century. And as in New Zealand, education has played a major role in the demographic reversal. In more recent times, the vulnerability and the rights of Indigenous peoples have assumed a global theme and have become part of a worldwide agenda. In 1949, the United Nations General Assembly identified a number of characteristics shared by Indigenous populations and emphasised the importance of reclaiming native languages and cultures. It was an important milestone, in modern Indigenous development. But for Indigenous people themselves, the retention of Indigenous values and customs, important as they were not necessarily the only or the most significant goals. Progressively, there has been a shift in aspirations from the 1949 focus on language and culture to a broader platform where the relevance of indigeneity to modern times has been articulated and the rights of Indigenous peoples to participate fully in society, in the economy, and in education have been championed. The modern agenda for Indigenous development across the globe is probably best reflected in the Declaration of Indigenous Rights. After 22 years in the making, the United Nations General Assembly finally approved the Declaration in 2007. The Declaration addresses both individual and collective rights, cultural rights and identity, rights to education, health, and among other things, rights to employment. It explicitly encourages harmonious and cooperative relations between states and Indigenous peoples. It prohibits discrimination against Indigenous peoples and promotes their full and effective participation in all matters that concern them. It has been described as a fundamentally remedial instrument that aims to overcome the marginalisation and discrimination endured by Indigenous peoples across the world following colonisation, conquest, and dispossession. Although the Declaration does not override domestic law, it is nonetheless an important aspirational statement against which all states, including those that did not sign the Declaration, and they were Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and some more, including those countries, the Declaration is a yardstick against which progress can be measured with an international framework. Meanwhile, since 2007, both Australia and Samoa have endorsed the Declaration. Indeed, Australia has gone further. On the 13th of September 2008, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd offered an apology to Australia's Indigenous peoples that recognised the legacy of trauma and grief they had suffered. That apology was to mark a beginning in which new hope was possible. Well, building on the foundations laid over the past quarter century, a new age is indeed approaching. In the new era, Indigenous participation in modern societies will not only reflect Indigenous values, Indigenous cultures and styles of leadership, but it will also be measured by high levels of inclusion in the professions, in a wide range of industries, in science, provider organisations, and in the arts. At a time when the globe is threatened by climate change, environmental instability, and food shortages, Indigenous worldviews have the strong potential to add insights into environmental management and eco-conservation and to refocus the balance between economic and social agendas. Although the circumstances of Indigenous people vary greatly, there are a number of themes that are common to Indigenous populations living in developed countries. Māori development in New Zealand over the past 25 years, for example, has highlighted four key themes. The first theme is about time, and it acknowledges that development needs to be measured over a period of decades rather than a period of years. Transformations do not occur overnight, and they're linked less to the resolution of immediate crises than to setting longer-term goals built around the needs of future generations. Too often, an exclusive focus on current problems obscures the vision of what could be and frames the Indigenous challenge as a series of calamities built around deficits and disparities. A second theme, at least in New Zealand, is linked to integrated development. Policies and programs based around the various sectors of health, economics, education, social welfare, the environment and justice often lead to disjointed efforts that fly in the face of Indigenous worldviews, where holistic understandings make much more sense than piecemeal approaches. Families do not live their lives in sectors, but are often subjected to sectoral interventions that have a fragmenting rather than a consolidating influence. Similarly, Indigenous engagement with academic institutions has often been complicated by a wide array of subject areas, each of which addresses part of the whole, but without conveying a real sense of consistency or holism. A third development theme revolves around Indigenous leadership. New patterns of Maori leadership have emerged over the past 25 years. Leaders are now more inclined to be strategic, forward-thinking, comfortable working at the interface between wider society and Indigenous worlds, and increasingly adept at leading tribal gatherings as well as chairing boardroom meetings. Moreover, the days of charismatic leadership constructed around one or two high-profile leaders have been increasingly supplemented by leadership networks that cut across sectors, tribes, industries, levels of education, political persuasions, and academic disciplines. The fourth theme is about relationships. Quite apart from alliances between the tribes, there has been an increasing trend towards future-focused relationships with the Crown, with the private sector, with industry, Indigenous peoples in other jurisdictions, and with the knowledge sector. Competitive and antagonistic interactions are giving way to relationships based around shared agendas for the future and a greater sense of joint ownership. Moreover, relationships are now frequently formalised as partnerships and carry expectations of equality and enduring associations. In that respect, Murrup Barrack, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development, is founded on the concept of partnership rather than on one-sided authority or narrowly defined expertise. A partnership is different from a merger insofar as it does not demand any loss of independence or loss of identity. And a partnership is the antithesis of a takeover, where equality is sacrificed for dominance and difference is transformed into sameness. In contrast, partnerships carry the promise of mutual benefits based on mutual contributions. There is a commitment to respect the integrity of the other and to avoid compromising the core values and the ideals that are dear to the traditions of each partner. Equality of voice, mutual trust, frequent opportunities for dialogue, and the identification of common goals will strengthen partnerships. But partnerships will be weakened by the onset of adversarial bargaining or unattainable expectations that must inevitably fail. In any event, engagement with the knowledge sector can be expected to deliver substantial benefits to Indigenous populations in the 21st century. The application of old understandings on the one hand and the creation of new pathways on the other have the potential to heighten appreciation of the nature of the world and to offer greater insights into human potential in the decades ahead. There is no single body of knowledge that can provide the total insights necessary for human advancement. Moreover, there are few opportunities to study at the interface between bodies of knowledge. Even when interface learning does occur, it is all too often accompanied by vigorous efforts to apply the criteria of one system to rationalise the basis for the other. In the process, validity and integrity are distorted, if not lost. That point was well made by Professor Ian Anderson in his 1993 Boyer lecture. He said, "Koori life experience and medical practice are not diametrically opposed. However, the skills required in getting consensus are not intuitive, nor are they necessarily facilitated by traditional modes of clinical interaction." The establishment of the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development signals a shift away from a parallel approach where different bodies of knowledge are locked into trajectories that never meet, and it signals a move towards a set of interacting pathways where a mix of ideas, values, and methodologies become available to accelerate inventiveness and add perspective to the human condition. An institute built on the several strands of Indigenous knowledge, together with the many disciplines of science, economics, jurisprudence, medicine, and the humanities, will have the potential to shape knowledge and inspire discovery in ways that have hitherto been unrealised. A number of beliefs underlie this notion of learning and research at the interface. But four principles have particular implication for both policy and practice, and they are mutual respect, shared benefits, human dignity, and discovery. The first of those principles, mutual respect, endorses the worldview of each party. Essentially, mutual respect recognises the validity of both knowledge systems, Indigenous knowledge and science, and accepts that each needs to be given its own space. Mutual respect extends to recognising different levels of expertise and alternate credentialing processes, as well as different appreciations of evidence and information transfer. A second principle, shared benefits, reverses outmoded assumptions about learning and research that often left Indigenous people as passive respondents who derived little or no benefit from the research. A major loss of confidence in universities occurred when the benefits were not apparent, except to academics, and Indigenous communities often felt both exploited and devalued in a process that disregarded their own views and their own autonomy. A share in the benefits of new knowledge also has particular implications for the assignment of intellectual property and the commercialisation of research findings. Human dignity is also an important principle for both teaching and research. It can be applied to relationships between teachers and learners, to research teams and communities, and between the university and the many populations it serves. The principle of human dignity implies that although worldviews may not be shared, personal integrity and cultural identity should not be devalued or lightly dismissed because they do not accord with the belief systems of others. Human dignity takes into account the worldviews of individuals and groups. It has ethical connotations and particular implications for the way teaching and research programs are designed, implemented, and applied without compromising spiritual beliefs. And the fourth principle, discovery, emphasizes both exploration and invention. Discovery of new knowledge is at the heart of all research endeavors. In research at the interface, discovery owes its innovation to insights drawn from two knowledge systems that have fostered explorations in directions not possible by recourse to one system only. As well, in addition to the notion of breakthrough, discovery also carries hope for the future. In that respect, no culture is static. Indigenous knowledge systems carry a formula for exploring the future, for understanding the nature and origin of phenomena, and the connections and relationships between phenomena. The application of the development themes and partnership principles has huge potential to generate new levels of Indigenous capability. University graduates who will take their place in the several professions of teaching, medicine, business, law, environmental management, while at the same time remaining close to their own people and contributing to their advancement. To a large extent, the realisation of that potential will depend on wise leadership and trusting relationships between leaders. In turn, effective leadership requires courage to move beyond institutional conventions, whether those conventions be exercised within Indigenous zones of comfort or inside the hallowed halls of learning, and to embrace difference as a source of inventiveness rather than a cause for suspicion. Leaders must be wise on two fronts. They must be able to establish relationships with each other, and they must be able to persuade their own people that a partnership with another group will bring beneficial results not otherwise attainable. As leaders in the academy, the university, Indigenous teachers and researchers play crucial roles in straddling the divide between Western academic teaching and research and Indigenous knowledge. They have access to Indigenous populations and also to two systems of knowledge. They are equally aware of the rules for engagement with Indigenous communities and the demands of robust methodologies. At the same time, they may well face criticism from two fronts. Indigenous communities may feel that Indigenous academics are tainted by Western academic conventions and have become somewhat detached from actual Indigenous experiences. Academics, on the other hand, may complain that Indigenous approaches introduce unnecessary variables such as ethical requirements which limit the integrity of their studies and confuse scientific principles with political imperatives. Both criticisms imply that pluralism at the interface will weaken integrity and undermine identity. But provided there is sound grounding in the two methodological streams and clarity about the contribution that each can make, those risks can be overcome. In addition, of course, to academic staff who can relate to the Indigenous situation and to Indigenous students, success will also be determined by the overall campus experience. Unless the wider culture of the learning environment can impart a sense of belonging, it will fail to capture sustained Indigenous attention. Strengthening identity and developing mastery can be facilitated through designated physical spaces, through cultural events, and counselling programs that aid the transition from native communities to university and later to professional life. Chancellor, it has been an honour to deliver the Ngarrindjeri Oration for 2009. And to witness the launch of Murrup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. We bring with us the good wishes of fellow Māori academics in New Zealand, from the Vice-Chancellor and academic staff at Massey University, and from the fellows of Te Mata o Te Tau, the Massey University Academy for Māori Research and Scholarship. Congratulations on establishing an institute that is destined to provide a model for development, not only in this country, but in all countries where Indigenous knowledge and academic disciplines have the opportunity to come together. And we applaud the efforts of Professor Ian Anderson for his leadership and vision over the years. Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, this oration has touched on some of the considerations that will be important to Indigenous development in the future. Over the past 25 years, adaptive Indigenous transitions have laid strong foundations for major transformations of communities, capabilities, and economies. States have progressively recognised the special significance of Indigenous populations, not only as bridges to past traditions and ancient wisdoms, but also as contributors to future development. There has also been an increasing realisation of the benefits that can accrue from Indigenous relationships with other entities, whether within the state or beyond the state. Especially important has been the development of relationships with the knowledge sector. Education in all its forms and with all the accompanying technology has been identified as a major highway for the next phase of Indigenous development. And in that respect, Indigenous partnerships with universities are about unleashing potential and promoting sustainable social, cultural, economic, and environmental transformations. the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development is well placed to play a leadership role by providing a forum where the knowledge resources of the university can be brought alongside the knowledge resources of Indigenous communities. The interface between the two knowledge systems can be a rich source of discovery and innovation with mutual gains and shared rewards. It also offers benefits to the nation, and in that respect, it will contribute to the Australian Prime Minister's aspiration for a new era of relations between states and Indigenous peoples. A key to success will be the way in which leaders in the Institute can gain the support of their followers and build enduring relationships with leaders in other parts of the university, with other Indigenous community leaders, and with Indigenous leaders in other countries. Possibly, however, the most important conclusion is that although Indigenous development is largely focused on today's urgent problems, those problems should not obscure the vision for the future. While the past 25 years or more have been about securing a place in modern societies, the next 25 years will build on those foundations so that Indigenous peoples, as members of increasingly global societies, can retain the customs and resources which are at the heart of their culture, while at the same time participating fully in education, in the economy, and in the development of an agenda for the future. And finally, kia tau hoki te marino, kia tipu ake te mātauranga, kia pūwai ngā moi moia a rātou mā i roto i te kotahitanga me te whakapono. May peace and calm always be with us. May knowledge and learning forever grow. And may the dreams of those who have since departed be realised in a spirit of unity and trust. Tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you, Chancellor.
Auntie Joy, Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Professor Anderson, Professors Jury. Professor Jury, you have given us a remarkable blueprint for the development of this important institute. You've talked about the coming together of knowledges and at the interface and at the partnerships that need to occur in the setting of mutual respect, of shared benefit and of human dignity. Your words, I think, have moved us all and have taken us, I think, that journey from our talk of Auntie Joy's elders and ancestors and to the time of 25 years ago when it was the difference between Indigenous and non-Indigenous that led perhaps to the leadership we've seen in your own case and also Professor Anderson. It is not a coincidence, I believe, that they are both physicians, one a psychiatrist and one also medically qualified. Professor Jury's work has been described as the most quoted part of his work related to Maori health and the concept of Wari Tapu Wā, and apologies for any mispronunciation, where he brought together a model of an understanding, a Maori understanding of health. And in that model, there are four dimensions to health. There's the physical well-being, the mental and emotional well-being, the social well-being, and the spiritual well-being. Each of those four dimensions influences and supports the others in what we now identify as a classic model of public health. Both Professor Jury and Professor Anderson have come from their areas of clinical expertise to recognise the great deficits there has been in Aboriginal and Indigenous health. But the talk tonight shows us how far we have moved beyond that. We have talked of closing the gap, we've talked about apologies, But now what we are recognising in the leaders from the Indigenous communities is not just the culture, but the knowledge that they bring. And it is a mutual respect of that shared knowledge that I think we will see so importantly played out in the Institute. So I thank you. You've laid down some firm challenges and some good guidelines for the development.
Professor Elliott, thank you, and may I join you in thanking Professor Drury for a wonderful speech, Professor Drury for a wonderful introduction to that speech, and Auntie Joy, who, as part of this community, is so often on campus and welcomes people so eloquently to this campus and makes us feel welcome as well. I'm unexpectedly honoured to be invited to launch the Murra-Barak Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. Unexpectedly, because this is other people's work. There's a group of people, particularly around Ian Anderson, who've worked for some years to make this a possibility, and tonight should be a reflection of their contribution. As you've heard, Murra-Barak is an attempt to capture the idea of the spirit of Barak. Wurundjeri elders, in talking with us about this, said this was the right name to lend the gravitas and the meaning to the new institute, and that's why the title's been chosen. And Ian has included the term Indigenous development because he wants to signal a focus on resources for Indigenous economic, social and cultural development. So this is a careful choice of words and a bringing together, as Professor Drury has just said, of two knowledges, two bodies of knowledge around a series of important questions. The intention is to make sure that this institute is a key part of the University of Melbourne. When we talk about the Melbourne model, we have a very special type of graduate in mind, graduates who are leaders with a profound awareness of community needs, who are attuned to cultural diversity, who have a high regard for human rights and equity. And clearly, understanding and respect for Indigenous culture and knowledge is crucial to those characteristics, to those attributes. In the apology to all Indigenous Australians in February 2008 that followed the national apology, this university committed to making a sustained contribution to raising the health, the education and the living standards of Indigenous Australians. And this institute is an expression of that commitment. It will have a crucial role in ensuring that we meet the commitment, meet it ourselves and meet it in partnerships, as Professor Drury has just so eloquently said. It will require strong, enduring interaction with Indigenous communities, with government and its agencies, with philanthropic organisations, with other universities, other forms of education, in order to realise this vision. We'll be looking to the Murra-Barak to coordinate many of these partnerships and to make sure that we remember the goals and pursue them vigorously. This is an opportunity to bring together research and teaching. It's an opportunity to make sure that Indigenous studies are firmly on the agenda of the Institute. It's an opportunity of welcoming to this university a whole range of scholars who wish to contribute. Along that 2-year or more path to set up the Murra-Barak, Ian and his colleagues identified nearly 200 of the university's academic staff who have an interest in some involvement or who have an interest and some involvement in areas of Indigenous studies and incorporate that in their teaching and their research and their knowledge partnerships. And indeed tonight, just before we processed, Ian mentioned that for the first time we had in a single procession most of the Indigenous academics at this university, a very proud moment for him, and you could hear the tear in his voice as he acknowledged that what an opportunity to bring together this extraordinary group of people, many of whom contribute to two really important themes at this university. The first is around Indigenous health. Around 100 researchers at the University of Melbourne have Indigenous health as one of their key objectives. And the second is work in Indigenous education. We, of course, also make significant contribution in areas of Indigenous art, culture and languages. Historically, the university has been good at retaining Indigenous students, and one of the best records of seeing Indigenous enrolments through to graduation. So we start from a strong base, but there's so much more that we need to achieve, and this is our vehicle for doing so. This is our commitment to doing so. Murra-Barak will give us not just a better profile in what we do, but new opportunities, opportunities in particular to build stronger relationships with Indigenous communities, opportunities to strengthen the impact of teaching and learning, opportunities to make sure that the conversation within the university also reaches out. It's one of the reasons we can see such great potential. And that potential is made possible by a number of very significant, dedicated Indigenous and non-Indigenous staff across this university who have committed their programs to the Muruk Barak. The first amongst these is the nationally distinguished academic, Professor Marsha Langton. She's held the Foundation Chair of Australian Indigenous Studies at this university since February 2000. She's made a significant contribution to Indigenous studies at three universities, to government and to non-government policy and administration throughout a long and very distinguished career. She has an international reputation, has published extensively on Indigenous affairs, including land rights, the mining industry and Indigenous communities, resource management and social impact. And she'll be a key part of this institute and a key inspiration for the work that's going on. We have five significant Indigenous programs at the University of Melbourne, and Muruk Barak Institute will build on their combined strengths. The first, and well known to many of our students, is the Centre for Indigenous Education, led by Chris Heelan. The centre provides services, support, encouragement, to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. It's responsible for our Indigenous education strategy. It's a significant part of the life of our Indigenous students. The Australian Indigenous Studies program, led by Philip Morrissey, is based in the School of Culture and Communications within the Faculty of Arts, a multidisciplinary program provided to students from across the university an opportunity to study the history and cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. One of the very encouraging changes once BRETS was introduced as part of the Melbourne model has been the significant number of students, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, who've chosen the courses that Philip and his colleagues have made possible and have brought in a whole range of people for the first time. The Willen Centre for Indigenous Arts and Cultural Development is led by Michelle Evans, a national centre dedicated to supporting Indigenous students in the arts and Indigenous artists. The Onemda Vic Health Koori Health Unit, under the leadership of Ian Anderson, has achieved an international reputation for its health research and teaching, and its programs are underpinned by the principles of Indigenous community development. And finally, the Academy of Sport, Health and Education, situated in Shepparton and led by Justin Mohammed, who's travelled here along with Paul Briggs to be part of tonight's launch. An innovative program has succeeded in retaining Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth in an education setting and providing opportunities. Each of these centres has made a significant contribution in their own right. Each has grown organically. This is a chance to bring them together, not just for administrative neatness, but rather to bring them together around a continuing conversation of what do we do together and how do we make this work. We see opportunities for coordination, for relationships, for reaching out, and for making sure that our Indigenous and non-Indigenous staff can see the whole array of opportunities that an institution this large can offer. We hope that the Institute will take a leading role in the development of the University of Melbourne Reconciliation Action Plan, and we expect it and hope that it will be a very important part of an institution committed to reaching out. So for all of these reasons, it's a great pleasure tonight to declare the Muruk Barak Institute for Indigenous Development formally launched. 3 weeks ago, Professor Ian Anderson, the recently appointed director of the new institute, submitted his draft strategic plan to the advisory board. It's an ambitious plan, a very ambitious plan, and I commend him for the vision that it contains and for his willingness to take on the challenge of directing this new institute. And so I'd like to invite Professor Ian Anderson to come and say a few words about where we're going and why. Ian.
Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Professors Jury, Auntie Joy, distinguished guests. Vice-Chancellor, I'd like to respond to your request by saying something more about the Institute by talking about values. And I'll do this by reference to two Aboriginal people of historical significance. William Barak, a Narrangator of the Wurundjeri clan, and whom we honour in naming this institute. And one of my forefathers, Manalagena, a statesman and leader of the Paramarana mob, whose extensive clan connections included Trawalaway and Plamamarana peoples. Manalagena was an elder of significance during the early part of the 19th century on the northeast coast of the island of Tawana, now called Tasmania. He was born before the establishment of the penal colony in Port Jackson and died in 1832 on Flinders Island in enforced exile, with a soul that was crushed by the unrelenting force of Tasmanian colonialism. They are two men who reflect the values that underpin our thinking in establishing Muruparak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. They are exemplars of a traditional Aboriginal leadership, a leadership in which authority was rooted both in knowledge and the reciprocal relationships between people and country. Although they were separated in time by a generation, and in geography by the deep, cold waters of Bass Strait, these two men shared something, many things in common. They both witnessed the cataclysmic demise of their world. The world of Manalagena was overturned by the pincer impact of the southern expansion of the Van Diemen's Land penal colony, and in the north by a lawless and voracious sealing trade that engulfed the southern hemisphere. For Barak, one short generation of land and gold lust left his people destitute, landless, stateless, and beggars in their own country. The buccaneering frontiersman John Batman also connects them. William Barak was a small boy when Batman the thief entered through Birrarung, as the Yarra was then known, to sign that so-called treaty with the Kulin elders somewhere near present-day Northcote. Before this, Batman was an infamous figure in the country of Manalagena. He was actively engaged in a campaign to remove the Aboriginal menace, and Manalagena was that menace. Manalagena had led a guerrilla-style resistance from the northeast coast that terrorised the good burghers of the penal colony. Batman led a roving party in the region. The roving parties were violent gangs charged with the removal of Aboriginal people dead or alive from the bush. The Hobart Town Courier reported in 1829, September 1, I quote, east of Ben Lomond, John Batman, the leader of a government roving party, made a dawn attack on an Aboriginal camp, numbering 60 or 70 men, women and children. In his report of the incident to the police magistrate of Oaklands, Batman estimated that 15 Aboriginal people died of wounds and that he executed two other wounded prisoners. Although Barak and Manalagena never knew each other, they were enmeshed in an extended network of Aboriginal relationships formed by those survivors of the cataclysm as they struggled to confront what had engulfed their universe. Manalagena had sought to create alliances with sealers in the Bass Straits to whom his clan daughters were married up for a life of hardship and sometimes frank misery, but one which nevertheless was outside the regime that incarcerated the Palawa or Aboriginal peoples of Tawana in the Waibelena establishment on Flinders Island. A grandson born by his clan daughter, Waratamata Tiena, Jack Briggs married up with a Bunroorang woman who eventually sought refuge via the Victorian goldfields in the settlement of Corranderk under the leadership of Barak and Simon Wonga. Both Barak and Manalagena shared the experience of failure and success. They both failed within their lifetime to realise the aspirations of their leadership, but in their struggle they succeeded in laying a foundation for generations to come. Corranderk was a viable settlement, economically productive, and a place where the Wurundjeri and other Kulin people such as the Bunroorang could settle down, eventually live, perhaps with no white man above them. Corindoke's demise was not a failure of leadership, but was the consequence of local avarice of land and the hardening of colonial policy, which from the 1886 Half-Caste Act resulted in the expulsion of people like the family of Jack Briggs, who eventually sought refuge in Cummeragunga, the Aboriginal mission in New South Wales. Their children and grandchildren were to become the most significant Aboriginal leaders of a generation. Manalagena died having failed to save his family and country. He died with the ache of land on his heart and on Flinders Island, where the mob would climb the hill and wail as they looked to the distant horizon of Chumana. But his daughters endured, and his descendants now number in the several thousand people spread through Tasmania and the southeastern mainland. Barak and Manalagena demonstrated a moral commitment to leadership that was based on knowing. Their knowledge was derived on a profound and deep understanding of country and ceremony. But it was not one that was simply backward-looking, but in a very real way engaged in confronting the challenges of their time. Vice-Chancellor, Chancellor, these are the values that are the foundation for Murup Barak, the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development. And on this foundation, our aim is to use knowledge to leverage change. The vehicle might be research or in the capabilities we produce in our graduates, but it's the vehicle that we as a university have committed to development. And this is an agenda that I am sure that we all present are committed to realising. For this commitment, I commend you all. Thank you.